such high levels remain hidden for so long? Nobody in the IRA was under any illusions about the willingness of the state to embrace unsavory tactics in this dirty, undeclared war. But if an agent is a murderer, and his handlers know that he is murdering people, does that not make the handlers, and as such the state itself, complicit? British Army sources would subsequently claim that the efforts of double agents saved many lives, but they allowed that such numbers could only be guesstimates, and this sort of thinking can degenerate pretty quickly into a conjectural mathematics of means and ends. If a spy takes 50 lives but saves some larger number, can that countenance his actions? This kind of logic is seductive, but perilous. You start out running numbers in your head, and pretty soon you are sanctioning mass murder. For years, when the provost made claims about collusion between the RUC or the army and loyalist paramilitaries, it was dismissed as propaganda. After all, the image that the British state had scrupulously cultivated for decades was that of the reluctant, impartial referee stepping into the fray when nobody else would to sort out two warring tribes. But the truth was that, from the beginning, the authorities perceived the provost as the main enemy, where their energies should be focused, and regarded loyalist terror gangs as a sideshow, if not an unofficial state auxiliary. As early as 1975, an army officer in Belfast wrote a letter to his boss warning about connections between loyalist paramilitaries and members of British intelligence and special branch, who appeared to have formed some sort of pseudo-gangs in an attempt to fight a war of attrition by getting paramilitaries on both sides to kill each other. In another letter, the following month, the officer expressed the view that the exploding violence of the Troubles could be attributed largely to British intelligence agents deliberately stirring up conflict. Loyalist gangs, often operating with the tacit approval or outright logistical assistance of the British state, killed hundreds of civilians in an endless string of terror attacks. These victims were British subjects, yet they had been dehumanized by the conflict to the point that organs of the British state often ended up complicit in such murders without any sort of public inquiry or internal revolt in the security services. All those bright lines that bureaucrats and legal scholars draw to delimit the government's monopoly on the legitimate use of force, those boundaries that are meant to separate order from barbarism, had been transgressed. We were not there to act like an army unit, one former British officer who served in the MRF later acknowledged. We were there to act like a terror group. One day in the late 1980s, Raymond White, a senior special branch officer who oversaw the handling of informants, met Margaret Thatcher and explicitly raised the danger of paramilitary collusion. I'm sitting here with the agents and handlers out there, and I feel somewhat uncomfortable, White told the Prime Minister, because I am asking them to do things that technically could be construed as criminal acts. White's remit was to recruit sources inside the paramilitaries. The paramilitaries steal vehicles, they build bombs, they kill people. To be a paramilitary is itself a criminal act, White said. He wanted a set of clear legal guidelines, he told Thatcher, that would spell out just what the state could authorise its informants to do, and what it couldn't. To continue functioning in a grey area could be dangerous, he felt. Thatcher considered the request, but in the end, she would offer him no such boundaries. To White, the message was clear. Carry on doing what you're doing, but don't tell us the details. Stakeknife was hardly the only paid double agent who had been alleged to have been a murderer. One of the top British informants on the Loyalist side was Brian Nelson, a former army officer who became a paramilitary with the Ulster Defence Association. After a stint in prison during the 1970s for kidnapping a disabled Catholic civilian and torturing him with a cattle prod, Nelson became an informant for the Force Research Unit, FRU, a shadowy army intelligence outfit that was a successor to the MRF. It was the FRU that employed Scapatici. In his day job as a loyalist paramilitary, Nelson's responsibility was to gather intelligence and particularly to assemble dossiers on Republicans who might make worthy targets for assassination. He would end up linked to some 50 murder plots. When Gerry Adams was wounded in the shooting by loyalist paramilitaries in 1984, he had suggested that the authorities must have known about the attack in advance. At the time, this charge may have seemed ludicrous. If the government had known beforehand of a plot to assassinate a member of parliament in a drive-by shooting during the lunch hour in busy central Belfast, surely it would have prevented the attack. But in fact, the government did know about the plot, because Nelson had tipped off his handlers. The government allowed it to proceed. One night in February 1989, a 39-year-old solicitor, Pat Finnegan, was at home eating Sunday dinner with his wife Geraldine and their three children in a prosperous neighbourhood in North Belfast, when gunmen crashed through the front door with a sledgehammer and murdered Finnegan, shooting him a dozen times. His wife was hit by a ricocheting bullet. His young children witnessed the whole thing. As a lawyer, Finnegan had advised many Republicans, but he was not a member of the IRA himself. Nevertheless, the authorities felt that he had become too close to the organisation. Members of the RUC had complained about lawyers who were effectively in the pockets of terrorists. It was Nelson who gathered information about Finnegan in advance of the shooting and supplied it to the execution team. The weapons used in the attack were supplied by a different man who had also been a police informant. A subsequent inquiry stopped short of concluding that there had been an overarching state conspiracy to murder Patrick Finnegan. But it did say that he would not have been murdered without involvement by elements of the state. Finnegan's family, convinced that there had indeed been an overarching conspiracy, rejected the findings of the inquiry as a cover-up and a sham. On one occasion in 1987, Brian Nelson saved Freddie Scapatici's life. A loyalist boss had given Nelson a list of provisional IRA members who were being targeted for possible assassination. Nelson dutifully passed the list along to his handlers in the FRU. One of the names on the list was Freddie Scapatici. At that point, Steak Knife had already been a valuable informant for a decade, and he stood poised to deliver an untold bounty of intelligence in the future. As an investment, he was still maturing nicely, so the presence of his name on a loyalist kill list prompted panic among his British handlers. Nelson himself did not know that Scapatici was also an informant. Any given mole rarely knew about the others, so the FRU devised a scheme to try to divert the murderous intentions of Nelson's loyalist associates. In the words of one member of the units at the time, the aim was to switch attention to another individual. The British Army handlers fed Brian Nelson the name of a different potential target, Francisco Natarantonio. A Belfast Italian, like Scapatici, Natarantonio was a former taxi driver. At 66, he was a pensioner, a father of 11, and a grandfather. What he wasn't was a member of the IRA. But Nelson's handlers made him out to be a major figure, a Provo godfather, someone easily on a par with Scapatici. One morning, Natarantonio was at home in his bedroom with his wife of 39 years when gunmen climbed the stairs and shot him dead in bed. When he was buried a few days later, hordes of mourners came out to the funeral procession. One of them was Freddie Scampatici, who had no inkling that the innocent man in the coffin had just been sacrificed so that he might live. In almost 30 years as a policeman, I had never found myself caught up in such an entanglement of lies and treachery, said Lord John Stevens, a top English police official. Stevens had been selected to conduct an investigation into the FRU and collusion between loyalist paramilitaries and the state, but his efforts were obstructed along the way. In 1990, a fire broke out in the office where Stevens and his team had been working. A subsequent police investigation concluded that the fire was an accident, but Stevens remained convinced that it was sabotage, an act of deliberate arson designed to destroy evidence of state collusion. In 2012, the British Prime Minister, David Cameron, acknowledged the existence of frankly shocking levels of state collusion. The Good Friday Agreement had contained a few specific clauses on criminal justice. There was a provision to free paramilitary prisoners who were being held at the time of the agreement, and under this framework, any sentence delivered in the future for troubles-related crimes would be capped at 2 years. Beyond that, however, there were no suggestions in the peace agreement for how to address the crimes of the past. There was no mechanism through which amnesty might be granted in exchange for testimony. Nor would the kinds of murders that the Nutting Squad and Nelson engaged in, and the state facilitated and condoned, be prosecuted as war crimes, because whatever the reality on the ground might have been, the Troubles were never declared a war. What this meant was that many unsolved murders of the Troubles would remain open criminal cases, in which ex-paramilitaries and ex-soldiers might yet be prosecuted. There was one notable exception. Under the 1999 legislation designed to help recover the bodies of the disappeared, a limited amnesty would be provided if people with knowledge of the particulars of these cases came forward to share it voluntarily with the authorities. One late summer evening in 2003, 18 months after the Castlereagh heist, a man named John Garland was walking along Shelling Hill Beach near Carlingford in the Republic. Garland had just taken his son and daughter for a visit to his mother's grave in a nearby cemetery, and now they were strolling back along the beach. The tide was going out, and the children wanted to catch crabs. As they capered on the damp shore, Garland's eye fell on something, a scrap of fabric sticking out of the sand. Approaching it, he picked up a piece of driftwood and used it to try to drag the material out, but it wouldn't budge. Curious, Garland pulled harder. Then he stopped suddenly as the material came loose and he caught sight of human bones. These were the disarticulated remains of an adult, a subsequent pathologist's report concluded. There were no soft tissues adherent to the bones, and the bones were crumbling. There was some evidence of plant growth on the bones. It was the skeleton of a woman. After counting the ribs and enumerating the other intact bones, the report noted, there was a single gunshot wound to the back of the head, which would have been sufficient to cause her death. A flattened lead bullet was recovered not far from the skull. 4 years after their long vigil in the summer of 1999, the McConville children reassembled on this stretch of beach, several hundred yards from the area that had been so comprehensively excavated in the earlier search. A series of recent storms had caused heavy erosion in the area, so, after remaining hidden for decades, the grave had gradually been uncovered by the elements. The skeleton's left femur was sent away for genetic profiling, along with DNA samples from Archie and Agnes McConville. But in the meantime, there was that fabric, a few tangled garments that had swaddled the bones over the decades in their unmarked grave. At a nearby morgue, the children of Jean McConville were ushered into a room one by one so that they could examine the clothing, which was laid out on a table. Tights, underwear, the remains of a skirt, a pink woolen top, the sole of a single shoe. Archie went in first, but he couldn't bring himself to look. Instead, he asked the question, "Is there a nappy pin?" A police officer surveyed the garments and said, "No, there wasn't." Then he folded over a corner of fabric, and there it was, 31 years after Jean McConville vanished, her body had been found. "My mother was a very good mother to all of us," Archie declared at a subsequent inquest. "All of our lives has been hell without her." Jean was reburied that November. The coffin was decorated with a spray of flowers, and the children accompanied it through the streets of West Belfast, pausing for a moment of silence when they passed Divis Tower, where Brendan Hughes still lived. Father Alec Reed, who had been so instrumental in the peace process, attended the funeral. But some others who accompanied the coffin felt that West Belfast was oddly quiet, as if the locals had been told to stay away, as if they were shunning the McConville family once again. When the remains of other individuals who had been disappeared were discovered, the chief focus was on recovering the bodies and burying them in consecrated ground. But the coroner in the McConville case ruled that Jean's body did not fall under the limited amnesty agreement governing the disappeared, because she was found not through the assistance of the IRA, but by a random member of the public who happened to walk on the beach. This had one very serious implication, the coroner declared. The criminal case remains open. 25. The last gun. Father Reed kept an eye on the gunman. He had agreed to serve as a witness to the decommissioning of the IRA's weapons, along with a Methodist minister, Harold Good. The process had unfolded in phases, and the precise technique that the IRA used to render its weaponry beyond use was a closely held secret. But it was said to involve sealing the weapons in concrete. Now, in 2005, the two clergymen had been summoned to oversee the destruction of the final batch. As they watched the process, Reed was distracted by the presence of one Provo official who stood nearby, holding an AK-47. Everywhere we went, this Kalashnikov was there, and I could see it was loaded, Reed said later. The gun was on display, he concluded, not because of any fear about what the clergymen might do, but because the provos needed to guard against an ambush by dissident paramilitaries who were not quite ready to give up fighting and might endeavour to repossess the arsenal. The destruction proceeded without incident, however, and once the clattering assortment of assault rifles, flamethrowers, mortars, and shoulder-fired missiles had been disposed of, the only weapon that remained was the Kalashnikov in the gunman's hand. Father Reed watched the man as he solemnly handed it over and noticed that he had become emotional. The man seemed very aware, Reed thought, that this was the last gun. While the IRA was decommissioning, Brendan Hughes was fulfilling a lifelong dream. With his brother Terry, he flew to Cuba. The two greying Irishmen visited the Che Guevara Memorial in Santa Clara and paid their respects at the mausoleum. They met some aging veterans of Cuba's revolution and bonded with the men. They posed for photos where Che fought. Brendan was delighted. When he got back to Belfast, Hughes grew increasingly ill. Struggling with a range of infirmities that dated back to his hunger strike 25 years earlier. One day, in 2008, he fell into a coma. His family surrounded him at the hospital, and veterans of D Company began to appear, knowing that their former commander was close to death, to pay their respects. One night, Jerry Adams slipped into the hospital. This caused some discomfort among Brendan's siblings, who knew that if he were awake, he might not welcome Adams. Hughes had taken to telling people, "There was a time in my life when I would have taken a bullet for Jerry Adams. Now, I'd put one in him." But the family chose not to intervene, and Adams went into the hospital room alone and sat in silence at Brendan's bed. Hughes died the next day. He was 59. The funeral, on a frigid day in February, was a massive affair. Dolores Price attended, as did Mackers, along with his wife Carrie. At one point, Price looked over and saw a familiar figure cutting through the crowd. It was Adams. For the Sinn Féin leader to show up at all was awkward. When Adams travelled the world now, he was embraced. He was a government minister, a peacemaker. People would queue just to shake his hand. They would reach out to touch his sleeve. But not here. Surrounded by men and women who had once taken his orders, at the funeral of a man who had been one of his closest friends, Adams was an outsider. In the judgment of Terry Hughes, Brendan's brother, Adams had little choice but to make an appearance. Brendan was a Republican icon. In the symbolic calculus of IRA politics, in which every funeral is a stage, Adams could afford to dissociate himself from Hughes in life, but not in death. Watching Adams, Price felt something unexpected, a pang of sympathy. He looked so uneasy in the crowd, she thought. He looked lonely. Still, he was nothing if not determined. Adams plunged into the cortege, maneuvering across the throng. Then he shouldered his way into the clutch of men carrying the coffin. "We were there in grief, not for photo opportunities," Price complained afterwards. But it was a bit late to be accusing Adams of a single-minded fixation on politics. After the burial, Adams told the Sinn Féin newspaper, Unfoblocked, that although Hughes had disagreed with the direction taken in recent years, he was still held in high esteem by all who knew him. "He was my friend," Adams remarked, before concluding with a Gaelic aphorism that translates roughly as, "He is on the way of truth." It was a sentiment that would soon prove to be more apt than Adams could possibly imagine. At the time Hughes died, the existence of the Belfast Project was still a closely guarded secret. But there were already indications that Sinn Féin's complete control of the narrative of the IRA history during the Troubles was beginning to fray. When Ricky O'Raw did his oral history with Mackers, he waited until the final session to reveal his long-held secret about how the Adams leadership had spurned an offer by the British government that might have ended the 1981 hunger strike before the last six strikers died. But O'Raw found the experience of unburdening himself so invigorating that as soon as he finished the interview, he resolved not to wait until his own death in order to release the story to the world. O'Raw had a big, round face, close-cropped grey hair, and a jovial sensibility. he was still relatively young and in good health. It could be decades before he died. Besides, he didn't want to restrict his story to the future students of Boston College. He wanted to tell it to the world. What O'Rourke really wanted to do was write a book. The idea sounded slightly outlandish and potentially dangerous. When Ed Maloney, the director of the Belfast Project, learned of O'Rourke's plan, he tried to warn him. The allegation that O'Rourke aimed to make public, that Gerry Adams had knowingly sacrificed the lives of 6 hunger strikers in order to advance the electoral prospects of Sinn Féin, was simply too explosive. "If you publish this, you'll be nailed to the cross," Maloney said. But O'Rourke was undeterred. "If I die before this comes out, all these geezers will be off the hook," he said. In 2005, he published the book. It was called Blanket Men, and it portrayed Adams as a cool-headed visionary, but also a slippery operator. No matter how history chooses to judge Adams in relation to the strike itself, O'Rourke wrote, "Without him and the hunger strikers, there would be no semblance of peace in Ireland today." This sort of nuance did nothing to placate those who perceived the publication of Blanket Men as a weaponized personal history aimed squarely at Gerry Adams. The Sinn Féin president did not respond to O'Rourke directly, preferring to remain aloof. Instead, as O'Rourke put it, he unleashed his Dobermans. An assortment of proxies and allies took to the press to hammer the book. Bic McFarlane, who had worked closely with O'Rourke during the hunger strikes, derided the book as totally fictitious, claiming that no deal had ever been offered by the British, so Adams couldn't have sent a message directing the prisoners not to accept it. Several years later, McFarlane changed his story and acknowledged that a secret offer had been made, but he insisted that it was the hunger strikers themselves, rather than the leadership, who deemed the offer unworthy and opted to continue the strike. If the attacks on Blanket Men were intended to silence O'Rourke, they had the opposite effect. He never missed an opportunity to publicly debate with anyone who might question the particulars of his story, and he decided that he would now write a second book about the strike and its aftermath. He also found that his willingness to tell a story that was at odds with Republican orthodoxy won him supporters. In a review in The Blanket, Dolores Price praised O'Rourke, thanking him for providing access to this vital piece in the jigsaw. Brendan Hughes had admired Blanket Men as well, and he came to its defence before he died. "I am a former prisoner whom O'Rourke talked to on a number of occasions about the things that concerned him, and which eventually appeared in his book," Hughes wrote, in a letter to the Irish News. In his final years, Hughes had got together with O'Rourke from time to time to share memories of their years in prison. "Dark, you should write all this down," O'Rourke would tell him. "Don't worry," Hughes said. "I've made tapes." One day in 2009, Dolores Price was arrested and charged with trying to steal a bottle of vodka from a Sainsbury's supermarket. Price maintained that she had not intended to steal the bottle. The shop had automated checkout counters with electronic scanners, and she simply got confused about the mechanism. Price elaborated that it was not in her temperament or breeding to take things from shops without paying for them. She was subsequently acquitted of shoplifting, but the truth was that Price had been struggling for some time with alcohol and drug addiction, and with PTSD. In 2001, she was caught with stolen pharmaceutical prescriptions and was found guilty of theft. A few years later, she was thrown out of McGabry Prison, where she had gone to visit a dissident Republican prisoner. Officials at the prison said that she was drunk, though she denied it. Friends were concerned. Price still spoke once a week to Eamon McCann, her old friend from Derry. She often wanted to talk about the past, but McCann would endeavour to steer her to other subjects. "Don't," he would say. "I don't want to know." like Ricky O'Raw, Price wanted to write about her days in the IRA. But McCann cautioned her against it. "Write about your childhood," he said. "Don't write about the IRA." Speaking out still invited fierce censor. In 2009, another IRA veteran, Jerry Bradley, wrote a memoir. Like Price, Bradley had contempt for the Shinners, as people often called members of Sinn Féin. Many of them, he felt, were freeloading on the IRA's achievements. Bradley told his co-author, a respected scholar of the Troubles named Brian Feeney, "The only thing I know is that I'm not an informer." Yet as soon as the book was published, Bradley's North Belfast neighbourhood was tagged with graffiti identifying him as a tout. "I'm just telling my story," he protested, insisting that he only wanted to put on record the truth of life in the IRA. Eventually, Bradley was forced to flee Belfast, seeking exile in Dublin. Ostracised and in poor health, he drove one day to a car park beside a Norman castle on Belfast Loch and took his own life. "Are they the only ones allowed to write books?" Ricky O'Raw asked indignantly after Bradley's death. "Is history never to be recorded properly?" As it happened, Brendan Hughes had made arrangements before he died. He asked Mackers and Ed Maloney to promise him that his own recollections would be published in book form. When the time came, Maloney volunteered to write the book, using the Boston College transcript of Hughes and that of another participant in the project. The loyalist politician and former UVF paramilitary David Irvine, who had also recently died, Maloney wrote a book called Voices from the Grave. It was published in 2010. In a preface, Bob O'Neill and Tom Hatchie from Boston College described it as the inaugural volume of the planned series of publications drawn from the Boston College Oral History Archive on the Troubles. The secret of the archive was officially out. The book would quote Hughes by name, not just asserting that Jerry Adams had been an IRA commander, but describing how Adams had personally ordered murders. Here was Hughes, saying in his own words that it was Adams who sent them to America to procure Armalites. It was Adams who sent the Loris Price to bomb London. It was Adams who ordered the killing of Jean McConville. The publisher, Faber and Faber, promised that Voices from the Grave would make it impossible for certain forms of historical denial to continue in public life. The publication generated enormous attention and a swift and lacerating backlash. "I knew Brendan Hughes well," Adams said when he was asked about the book. He wasn't well and hadn't been for a very long time, including during the time he did these interviews. Brendan also opposed the IRA cessations and the peace process. Adams, who would soon be elected to a seat in the Doyle Éireann, the legislature of the Republic of Ireland, rejected absolutely any suggestion that he had played a part in the Jean McConville case or in any of the other allegations that are being promoted by Ed Maloney. Sinn Féin issued a blanket pronouncement that anyone participated in the Belfast Project had a malign agenda. Attention soon turned to Anthony McIntyre, who was identified in the book as the person who had interviewed Hughes. Mackers had long since fallen out with people in the circle around Adams, but now he began receiving threats. One night, someone smeared the house of one of his neighbours with excrement. Wrong address, apparently. A gesture whose combination of vindictiveness and clumsiness had all the hallmarks of the IRA. In one press report, an unnamed Republican said that Mackers would go the same way as Eamon Collins, a Newry man who was stabbed to death in 1999, not long after publishing his own memoir about life in the IRA. But Voices from the Grave received strong reviews, and Ed Maloney went on a book tour. he had plans to launch a documentary on Irish television that would include audio from Hughes's oral history. Then, one day in summer 2010, Danny Morrison, the longtime friend and ally of Gerry Adams, contacted Boston College and requested access to the Hughes tapes. During the Troubles, Morrison had been the chief propagandist for the IRA, the man who is credited with coining the phrase the Armalite and the ballot box. If Hughes delivered the oral history to Boston College with the understanding that it would not be made public until his death, and if Hughes was now dead, then surely Morrison could access not just Maloney's book, but the original tapes themselves? When the college forwarded this request to Maloney and Mackers, they panicked. Under no circumstances should Morrison be granted access, Maloney said. In an email to Tom Hatchie at Boston College, Mackers wrote, "Danny Morrison has no intellectual interest in the tapes. He is not an academic or an investigative writer, but a propagandist." It may simply have been the flush of euphoria when the Belfast Project was originally conceived, in the aftermath of the Good Friday Agreement, but at no point had any of the project's architects contemplated a scenario like this. In fact, there were quite a few fairly important points upon which their original conception of the project had been ambiguous. For instance, Wilson MacArthur, Anthony McIntyre's counterpart, who conducted all the interviews in the Loyalist community, had been under the impression, as he was gathering the oral histories, that none of the interviews would be made public until all of the participants had died. He was caught off guard by the news that Maloney intended to publish Voices from the Grave just a few years after the last of the interviews had concluded, thereby revealing the existence of the archive when the first participants had died, rather than waiting decades until the last ones had. The men had also never decided just who would be allowed to access the interviews. The conversations had always been about the future students of Boston College, but the history department at the college had not known, until the publication of Maloney's book, that the project was happening at all. In fact, the archive had been so secret that almost nobody at Boston College, apart from Hatchie and O'Neill, knew that it existed. One history professor, when he learned about the project, sent a PhD student he was supervising to the Burns Library to consult the Hughes and Irvine interviews for her thesis. But when he found out about this arrangement, Ed Maloney objected, "I would strongly urge you now to close the archives to any and all future access," Maloney wrote to Hatchie. "There should be a strict protocol," he proposed. "Anyone could apply to access the interviews, but the list of applicants should be sent to Maloney for vetting." In an email to Mackers, Hatchie expressed his indignation. If the perception had been from the outset that the project would be mothballed for a lengthy time, Boston College might not have been so supportive, he pointed out. "We never got as much as a hint that there was any expected fallout," he complained. The university could not be expected to close the archive to the entire scholarly and or journalistic world, other than to Ed Maloney. From the beginning, the two Irishmen and the two Americans, Maloney, McIntyre, Hatchie and O'Neill, had enshrouded the Belfast Project in secrecy because they recognised just how sensitive and potentially dangerous an undertaking it was. Out of this concern for operational security, they kept the circle of people who knew anything about the project extremely small, and, for the better part of a decade, until the publication of Maloney's book, they scrupulously preserved this need-to-know ethos. But the very smallness of the circle may have led them to take certain things for granted and prevented them from asking important questions about how to manage the process if the whole thing unravelled and their most paranoid, worst-case scenario fears came true. Just prior to the publication of Voices from the Grave in February 2010, Gerry Adams gave a long interview to the Irish News in which he was asked about Joe Linsky, the mad monk of the IRA, who was the first person to be disappeared in the Troubles after he was court-martialed for ordering a hit on his love rival, which led to the shooting at the Cracked Cup. When the IRA acknowledged in 1999 that it had disappeared people and released a list of names, including the informants, Seamus Wright and Kevin McKee, as well as Jean McConville, Linsky was not on the list. In fact, it had been Ed Maloney who first informed the Linsky family before publishing the story in Voices from the Grave that Joe had been disappeared by the IRA. When the Irish News interviewer questioned Adams about Linsky, he said casually, "He was a neighbour of mine." Asked if he had been friends with Linsky, Adams said, "Oh yeah, I knew him and he disappeared." He added that he would encourage anyone who might have information about Linsky's disappearance to come forward now. At her home outside Dublin, Dolores Price read the interview and it made her furious. She might not have spoken to Adams for years, but she maintained a conversation of sorts with him through her articles in The Blanket. "I knew you way back when," she reminded Adams in one column. Was it the interfering cleric who had diverted Adams from the cause, she wondered, in a possible reference to Father Alec Reed? Or was it the flattery of the Americans? "Did it go to your head?" she asked him. "Did the ego soar? And at last did you see the possibility that you might be somebody?" Again and again, she came back to her feeling of personal and political betrayal. "You didn't do it for a couple of houses and a good suit on your back, surely?" she asked. "I'm all curiosity." Adams never responded to these provocations, and Price, spurned anew, could occasionally turn menacing. "I look forward to the freedom to lay bare my experiences," she wrote in 2005, adding, "This is the only freedom left to me." Price had taken lately to telephoning journalists when she felt like talking. She would be sitting at home, sometimes with a glass of something in her hand, and slide into a doleful reverie about the past. It wasn't just that she was lonely. It was that she was seized, in these moments, by a defiant impulse to set matters straight. To testify. "Dolores, what the fuck are you doing?" Eamon McCann would protest, pointing out just how hazardous it could be for her to ring up a journalist for a chat about her history. But to McCann, it seemed that Price was filled with a great rage she could scarcely control. When she read the Adams interview about Linsky in February 2010, she reached for the telephone. The next morning, a Belfast journalist named Alison Morris got to work at the Irish News and discovered a stack of messages waiting for her. Price, it seemed, had been ringing the night desk at the newspaper all night. As it happened, Morris had grown up in Andersonstown, like Price. She was an aggressive reporter, blonde and slightly brassy, with impeccable Republican sources. She made the trip to Dublin, where Price was waiting to meet her. Morris had interviewed her fair share of ex-paramilitaries, and she was acquainted with the relevant hazards. Warped by trauma, such men and women often navigated their days in a fog of alcohol and prescription drugs. She had interviewed Brendan Hughes on a number of occasions before he died, and she sometimes had to stop the interviews because he was drunk. But when Price came to the door and greeted Morris and her photographer, she seemed sober and coherent. Her hair was short and dyed a platinum blonde, and she wore a cardigan and a red scarf looped around her neck. Morris was struck by her poise and beauty. Price seemed to her, as she did to so many, like a theatre person, a bohemian. Price wanted to talk about the disappeared. What had set her off was the blitheness with which Adams discussed the disappearance of her old friend Joe Linsky, as though it were some act of God rather than an atrocity that Adams himself had ordered. "Linsky was a gentleman," Price told Morris. She should not have allowed him to go to his death. She should have helped him flee the country. It devastated me. It still does, she said. I should have done more. You do realize you're implicating yourself, Morris said. I don't care anymore, Price said. The man's a liar. The two women had been talking for some time when Morris looked up and was startled to see a boy hovering uncertainly in the doorway. He had pale skin and dark, shaggy hair. He was the splitting image, Morris thought, of Stephen Ray. It was Danny, Dolores' son. He was holding a telephone. My Aunt Marion wants to speak with you, he said to Morris. When Morris got on the phone, Marion Price was furious that she might be conducting an interview. She explained that Dolores had been receiving treatment at St. Patrick's, a mental health facility in Dublin. She is not well, Marion said. She should not be talking to people. Your sister's a grown woman, Morris protested, but Marion was insistent. After leaving the house, Morris consulted with her boss and tried to think of a way to salvage the interview. The solution she ended up devising was to write a slightly anodyne version of the story and say that Dolores Price intended to confess to the Independent Commission for the location of victims' remains. Because anyone who approached the commission with information would, in theory, receive immunity from prosecution. The article was published a few days later under the headline, Dolores Price's Trauma Over IRA Disappeared. It said that Price had vital information to share about the disappearances of Joe Linsky, Seamus Wright, and Kevin McKee. But it did not spell out any of the details. Morris also noted that Price had information about the final days of mother of 10 Jean McConville. Before the article ran, Morris telephoned Price and asked if she had contacted the commission. Price lied and said that she had. 3 days after Morris's article was published, a Belfast tabloid called Sunday Life put out an article of its own. Under the headline, Jerry Adams and the Disappeared, this article featured precisely the types of details that Morris had omitted from hers, and it attributed these details to the terrorist in a miniskirt who married a movie star, Dolores Price. According to Sunday Life, Price fingered Adams directly, saying he had played a key role in disappearing victims. When Price picked up Joe Linsky before he was killed, she did so on the orders of Jerry Adams. Price said that she had also driven Jean McConville across the border to her death. Some members of the IRA had wanted Jean's body dumped in the middle of Albert Street, but Price maintained Jerry Adams argued against that, saying that doing so would be bad for the image of the provost. These charges were devastating in their specificity and dovetailed quite precisely with the account by Brendan Hughes. But there was something peculiar about the article in Sunday Life. To begin with, the author, Kieran Barnes, did not appear to have spoken to Dolores Price himself. Instead, he cited a tape-recorded confession by Price, which Sunday Life had heard. But what was the confession? Elsewhere in the article, Barnes wrote that Price had made taped confessions of her role in the abductions to academics at Boston University. Apart from the erroneous name, Boston University and Boston College are separate institutions. The implication was unmistakable. It appeared that Kieran Barnes, a Belfast tabloid journalist, had somehow listened to the Boston College tapes of Dolores Price. When Ed Maloney learned about the Sunday Life story, he reacted with alarm. The article clearly intimated that Barnes had accessed the archive at Boston College. But Maloney knew that this could not be true. The recordings had been held under lock and key in the treasure room at the Burns Library. What's more, Maloney could point to another reason why Barnes could not have access to the tapes. In her recorded interviews with Makars, Dolores Price had never mentioned Jean McConville, because Makars had warned her against doing so. Dolores Price did not once mention the name Jean McConville, Maloney wrote in a subsequent affidavit. If Barnes hadn't heard the Boston tapes, then which confession was he referring to? As they tried to fathom what had happened, Maloney and Makars arrived at a theory. Alison Morris and Kieran Barnes were friends and former colleagues who had worked together in the past at the Andersonstown News. Maloney and Makars knew about the abortive Irish News interview that had been halted by Marion Price. They concluded that after publishing her own defanged version of the Price story, Morris must have shared the tape of her interview with her friend Barnes. In the article, Barnes wrote about hearing a taped confession and also said that Dolores Price had made a taped confession for the Belfast Project. The article implied that there was only one taped confession, but in fact, there were two. Alison Morris denied sharing her interview with Barnes. Barnes would say only that he would be remiss to talk about his sources. Jerry Adams, meanwhile, angrily contested Price's claims, noting that she was a long-standing opponent of Sinn Féin and the peace process. Price was suffering from trauma, Adams pointed out, adding, "There obviously are issues she has to find closure on for herself." It was the same criticism Adams had levelled at Hughes, who he characterised as having his issues and his difficulties. If Adams had indeed been the commanding officer of both Price and Hughes, this talking point could be interpreted as surpassingly callous. Both were indignant because Adams had ordered them to take brutal actions, then disowned them, claiming that they alone bore moral responsibility, because he was never in the IRA. When each finally spoke up, Adams maintained that they were lying, and in order to discredit them, pointed to the genuine trauma they were experiencing. Adams himself seemed conspicuously undaunted by the past. So many others were tortured by what they had experienced in the Troubles, but he never looked as though he had lost a night's sleep. Brendan said what Brendan said, he told one interviewer, and Brendan's dead, so let it go. 26. The Mystery Radio. For the McConville family, the nearly simultaneous revelations of Ed Maloney's book about Brendan Hughes and the newspaper stories about Dolores Price were painful. Both Hughes and Price had insisted that Jean was an informant, and Hughes had described in detail how she was discovered in possession of a radio. This new information appeared to reopen a matter that the McConvilles had felt was conclusively settled. In 2006, the police ombudsman for Northern Ireland, Nuala O'Loan, released a report on the death of Jean McConville. O'Loan found that the authorities had never conducted any sort of proper investigation into the abduction, but she located intelligence files from the time that recorded rumours suggesting that McConville had been abducted by the provost because she is an informer. When she searched old military and police files, however, O'Loan was unable to locate any records that mentioned McConville prior to her disappearance, or any suggestion that she might have been working as an agent in Divis Flats. In her report, O'Loan pointed out that the United Kingdom has a policy to neither confirm nor deny whether any particular individual has served as a clandestine agent of the state. Nevertheless, she wrote, this situation was unique. That family has suffered extensively because of the allegation that their mother was an informant, she noted, and because Jean was long since dead, no harm could come to her now. She is not recorded as having been an agent at any time, O'Loan wrote, before concluding more forcefully, she was an innocent woman who was abducted and murdered. This emphatic declaration felt like a vindication to Jean's children, who for decades had asserted that their mother was unfairly maligned because she came to the assistance of a wounded British soldier. "I am glad my mother's name was cleared," Michael McConville said after the report was released. "We knew throughout the years it was all lies." Not everyone was ready to accept O'Loan's report as the final word, however. Even after her findings were announced, the provost stuck to their original position, saying in a new statement that the IRA had conducted a thorough investigation of its own into the circumstances surrounding McConville's murder, and had confirmed that she was working as an informer for the British Army. The statement singled out Michael McConville by name and acknowledged that he might dispute the provost's account before adding, acerbically, "The IRA accepts, he rejects this conclusion." Ed Maloney and Anthony McIntyre also continued to believe that McConville had been an informant. Their confidence in the oral history of Brendan Hughes was unshakable. To Maloney, it seemed like Nuala O'Loan, influenced by her obvious sympathy for the McConville children, simply chose to arrive at the categorical conclusion that would be most comforting for them. As a hard-nosed reporter, Maloney had an outlook that was more clinical and unsparing. In his view, the fact that O'Loan could not retrieve any records indicating that McConville was a spy hardly settled the matter. Which of the many secret archives of British military records had O'Loan consulted? She refused to specify. Perhaps there were records that she had not discovered. Has she really left no stone unturned? Mackers believed that the army or the police might have deliberately covered up Jean's involvement. If she had been a tout, and she was warned by the IRA to stop, it would look pretty terrible for the authorities to give her another radio and send her back to work, when such a move was so likely to get her killed. There was also a mystery relating to the detail of the radio itself. Some former police officers, like Trevor Campbell, maintained that neither the army nor the police were using handheld radios to communicate in those days, much less to communicate with informants. But Ed Maloney, working with a researcher who had served in the British Army, dug through old British files and found evidence of a small radio that was used by the army in Belfast in 1972. They even managed to track down a photograph of a British soldier squatting against the wall in full battle flak, holding this type of radio in Divis Flats. Even if such a radio did exist, however, it would be folly to give the device to a low-level informant who lived with a bunch of children in an intensely Republican area. And what about those thin walls in Divis Flats? You couldn't have a casual conversation over a cup of tea without the neighbours in the next flat overhearing. So making covert transmissions on a clandestine radio would pose serious risks. When Michael McConville studied the recollections of Brendan Hughes, he was struck by the fact that Hughes never said that he had personally seen the radio in question. Perhaps this was just a rumour that got passed around Belfast for long enough that over the years it became accepted as fact. Perhaps it was a story that the people who murdered Jean McConville told one another, or told themselves, in order to feel less awful about what they'd done. Michael also wrote off as ludicrous and insulting the suggestion by Hughes that the McConville siblings might somehow have assisted their mother in any conspiracy to spy on their neighbours. But there was another mystery that was compounded by the publication of the Brendan Hughes account. It involved the timeline of Jean McConville's disappearance. In her investigation, Nuala O'Loan was not able to recover any official documents giving a precise date for the night Jean McConville disappeared. The children had always maintained that one evening in early December, Jean had gone to play bingo and had been seized, questioned, and beaten before she was discovered wandering in a daze by the army and brought home to Divis Flats. It was the following evening that she was taken away, according to the children's memory. She was still nursing the bruises from her beating. While the children could not be absolutely certain about the date, they believed that Jean was abducted on the 7th of December, 1972. This timeline would seem to contradict the story told by Brendan Hughes, who recalled McConville being questioned and having the radio seized, then returning to work as an informant and, sometime later, being caught with a second radio. The story that Hughes told, which Dolores Price endorsed and the IRA officially maintained in its statements, was that Jean McConville was not just an informant, but a recidivist. That she was warned to stop helping the British and then murdered only after she defied the warning. But if McConville was questioned and warned on the night of the 6th of December and then abducted from her flat the following night, the timeline Hughes asserted would make no sense. Even in a scenario in which McConville's ostensible British handlers were callous enough to put her back to work after the warning, it seems unlikely that they would do so, and even supply her with a new radio within 24 hours. The McConville children embraced O'Loan's report as a complete exoneration of their mother, a decades overdue affirmation of everything they had been saying for years. But in a few significant particulars, the report was actually at odds with the family's version of events. In her review of historical documentation, Nuala O'Loan discovered an official record that seemed to describe the night Jean was taken from the bingo hall by the IRA for questioning. According to an old police log, a woman was found wandering the streets in West Belfast one night at 11 p.m. She had been beaten. The log noted that her name was Mary McConville, but clearly this was Jean. Her address was listed as St. Jude's Walk in Devis Flats. The log stated that the woman had been accosted by a number of men and warned to stop giving information to the military. Setting aside the question of whether the IRA was correct or mistaken in believing Jean to be a tout, this document appeared to corroborate the claim that a warning had been issued to her. But the police log was a significant clue for another reason as well. According to the log, McConville was found wandering the streets after the beating and the warning, not on the night of the 6th of December, as the children's account suggested, but 7 nights earlier, on the 29th of November. Michael McConville and his siblings were just kids in 1972. They lived in a war zone. Their mother had been taken, and they were forced to steal and scavenge for food in the midst of tumult and tragedy. Nobody is consulting the calendar. And memory is a strange thing. Helen remembers that on the day after Jean was taken from the bingo hall, the younger children went to school. Michael remembers that they stayed at home. It could be that the McConville siblings simply got the dates mixed up in retrospect and that Jean was actually questioned on the 29th of November and taken away on the 30th of November. But from the very first press interviews and accounts to social services that they gave beginning in January 1973, the children were emphatic that their mother was taken in early December, not late November. If the date of the abduction is accurate, and the police log that O'Loan discovered is reliable, then it would seem that more than a single night may have elapsed between the initial interrogation and warning and the moment Jean McConville was taken away. If that were the true chronology, then it would look a lot more like the timeline proposed by Brendan Hughes. There was one final confounding detail in O'Loan's report. For decades, the McConville kids had talked about the night their mother came to the aid of the wounded British soldier in Devis Flats. More than one of the children could recall vivid details from that evening. The family huddled in the darkness of the flat, the staccato pop of gunfire in the concrete corridors, the soldier's anguished moan outside the door. But when O'Loan consulted army records from the period, she could find no evidence of a British soldier being wounded in the vicinity of Devis Flats. Perhaps the records were incomplete, or perhaps there was some mistake regarding the nature of the soldier's injuries, or the period in the lives of the McConvilles when the episode took place. But it was tempting to wonder whether the children of Jean McConville, like the people who abducted her, had not constructed a legend around the vanished woman that they could live with. Brendan Hughes may have been dead by the time it was revealed that he had direct knowledge of the McConville's disappearance. But Dolores Price was still alive. When the Sunday Life article was published in 2010, the McConvilles were shocked that Price would speak so freely about her involvement in an operation that had been a closely guarded secret for so many years. Ravenous for more information, Michael sent a message through intermediaries that he would like a meeting with Price, but he never heard back from her. Helen greeted the story with an angry challenge to the authorities. "Arrest the pair of them, Adams and Price," she said. "It's disgusting that the people involved in my mother's murder are still walking the streets." The Sinn Féin president and his outspoken antagonist might not have pulled the trigger, Helen allowed, but they were as guilty as the people who did. One bright, chilly morning the following spring, Ed Maloney was at home in the Riverdale section of the Bronx when he received a phone call that filled him with alarm. Boston College had just received a subpoena. The U.S. Department of Justice, acting under a mutual legal assistance treaty with the United Kingdom, was passing on an official request from the Police Service of Northern Ireland. The request was made. The subpoena stated, "In order to assist the authorities regarding an alleged violation of the laws of the United Kingdom, namely, murder." Specifically, the subpoena demanded the original tape recordings of any and all interviews of Brendan Hughes and Dolores Price. 27. The Boston Tapes. I always, probably to the point of being boring, asked about the legal status and confidentiality, Mackers fumed. Total confidentiality and total protection. This was the whole reason for putting them in a US university. An emergency conference call had been convened among the chief architects of the Belfast project to discuss what to do about the subpoena. Along with Mackers and his wife, Carrie, outside Dublin, the call was joined by Ed Maloney in New York. Wilson MacArthur, who had conducted the Loyalist interviews in Belfast, and Tom Hatchie and Bob O'Neill at Boston College. Hatchie announced that he had spoken with the president of the college, William Leahy, and that Leahy had assured him, "We are not going to allow our interviewers or interviews to be compromised." Mackers and Maloney were in a state of panic. During the years when they were compiling the oral history archive, they had never believed that British authorities might seriously endeavour to access the recordings. The very idea seemed ludicrous. Just a few months earlier, the British government, along with the Government of Ireland, had entrusted a raft of sensitive documentation associated with the post-Troubles disarmament process to Boston College, on the understanding that the records would be sealed for up to 30 years. Could officials from the same government really be seeking, now, to violate a similar embargo at the very same university? Administrators at Boston College had been consulting with lawyers, and it was not yet clear how the university would respond. On the call, Hatchie and O'Neill were unflustered and reassuring, but Mackers expressed a fear that BC might ultimately comply with the request and turn over the tapes, that the interviewers and the ex-paramilitaries who shared their secret histories might simply be hung out to dry. Maloney shared this fear and, as a form of insurance against any quiet, dead-of-night handover, he had already gone public. He contacted the New York Times, which ran a front-page story secret archive of Ulster Troubles faces subpoena. He also spoke to the Boston Globe, suggesting in an interview that Boston College might be left with no choice but to destroy the tapes rather than turn them over to the authorities. To Maloney and Makars, it seemed that nothing less than the principles of free speech and academic freedom hung in the balance, and the more publicity the case received, the more likely Boston College would be to do the right thing. But Hatchie scolded Maloney for going straight to the press without consulting university administrators first, and he complained that the threat about destroying the archive had been over the top. Nobody in the group knew what was driving this sudden request for the interviews, but Maloney had a suspicion. The Police Service of Northern Ireland might be striving on paper to become a new kind of department, but while the police had changed the name of the constabulary, they were still, in many instances, the same police. For decades, the men of the RUC had perceived Gerry Adams to be their chief antagonist, the figurehead of a paramilitary outfit that murdered nearly 300 police officers over the course of the Troubles. Many old hands in the PSNI had lost loved ones, fellow cops, childhood friends, fathers, at the hands of the IRA. Now they had become aware that across an ocean at Boston College there existed an archive featuring testimony by former subordinates of Gerry Adams, and that these secret interviews might furnish the kind of proof that had eluded British authorities for decades, evidence that could put Adams away, not just for IRA membership, but for murder. "This is a vendetta that is being waged," Tom Hatchie said on the conference call, agreeing with Maloney. "They're out to try and find something they can nail a person like Gerry on." He added, "I'll be goddamned if they're going to use our archives to indict them, because that's not what we undertook this enterprise for." Hatchie certainly sounded adamant. But as he and Bob O'Neill questioned the others about the particulars of the project, Maloney thought that he detected, in the line of questioning, a hint that Boston College might not be feeling quite so resolute as Hatchie was making it sound. They were very curious about the precise guarantees that McIntyre and Wilson MacArthur had made at the time they conducted the interviews. What exactly had the interview subjects been promised in way of confidentiality? Before he interviewed his loyalist subjects, MacArthur said he had assured them that there was an ironclad guarantee of confidentiality. Their testimony would be released to no one, nor would it ever be acknowledged that they had participated in the project at all, until after their death. MacArthur reminded Hatchie and O'Neill that they themselves had used the word ironclad when they first discussed the archive a decade earlier. When he encountered skittish participants, MacArthur would tell them that Boston College's legal counsel had vetted the whole arrangement. As it turned out, this was not actually true. When Ed Maloney was preparing the